What's going on, guys? Welcome to this latest episode of River City 93, brought to you by Roughnecks, Cars, Icarus FC, and of course, For the Culture. This is your host, as always, Elliot Barr, and is joining me are two men that could probably be in the team of the week for Richmond as we kept the clean sheet. It's Matt and Janier. How are you doing, guys?
Not too bad. I mean, kept the clean sheet, so did the other team, but we're creating chances, so I'm happy.
That's the point of a draw, Janier.
Yeah, I do not belong in the team of the week.
You could be in there for tactical organization,
coach of the week, organization, logistical management.
There you go. We're out here giving out fake degrees and stuff.
Okay, I'll get in there when I earn it.
So, first of all, let's go and congratulate Akiris Fitzgerald and Jalen Chrysler for getting it team of the week. Give it up to him. We did talk about it pre-show about how we kind of think Akira is giving these awards to himself as part of management. So, yeah. What is this, like his third one?
It's at least two. I can't remember off the top of my head if he got one or if they even gave it out the first week when we had a clean sheet against New England or not, but certainly the last two games, he's gotten that award. But no, I mean, he's clearly not giving himself team of the week. He's giving himself man of the match, because he can actually lean on the comm staff as fellow management to be able to be like, hey, get that clean sheet, look me up.
And look, we got a new person in the communications office now, as Mr. Patrick Wood has retired. I don't know if you can call it retired, but probably retired, off to do better things to save a little bit of gas, as he doesn't have to drive all the way to Fredericksburg every day. But, he probably is pushing on Nate and being like, hey, look, you want to keep your job, make me man of the match every week. Regardless of that, make me man of the match.
I mean, you can't prove it didn't happen.
Yeah, big shout out to Patrick Wood. They gave him a good send off. Red Army gave him a good send off, I must say. So
yeah, I ain't gonna lie. I low key thought Patrick was crying, and then I realized, like, oh no, he just covered his face. Like, he's all he does.
Yeah, and for anyone who's not up on your front office, Richmond Kickers news, Patrick was with the team for like 12 years. It's basically the main comms guy, as the director of communications the last few years as the team expanded out. And he announced this last week that it was going to be his last week with the team. He's been with them, for a long time, kind of, really ever present and moving on to the next step of life. I can't blame him. 12 years is a long run for anyone at any job, but it doesn't mean we're not going to miss him, not going to miss being able to needle him from time to time. But also, he's been a great supporter of the team, of this podcast along the way. So Patrick, looking forward to that tell-all memoir of life as a minor league soccer communications guy. Look forward to that coming up. You got a lot of free time now in a couple weeks, right?
Look, it's literally gonna be the end. That's Patrick. Literally not gonna say anything.
Oh, I bet he's got stories if he wants to tell them.
Oh, he probably does.
Oh, man. And, he was like the club historian, quote unquote. So Patrick probably got stories for days. Oh, man. Gonna miss not having Patrick now. But let's go ahead and hop into this game. As for those who know, we played North Carolina FC. The league was kind of hyping it up as a derby. Let me ask you guys, do you guys feel like it's a derby, or do you think it's one of the things that has to grow?
It's not a derby, and it would take a game where a lot of drama happens for it to become a derby, and that wasn't this Saturday.
So I don't know. I think y'all use that word way too often as it is anyway. Ellie, I feel like you want to make every random game some kind of a rivalry game against somebody else. Which, I mean, Brandon, go for it. If you're looking at the old school strict, British interpretation of it, I mean, in American sense, 2.5 hours is a close rival. So on that level, yeah, I'm on board for it, because you know, any game that, you know, where fans can actually be able to reasonably go to, you know, to and come home that same day, I'm on board for. I mean, we've been, you know, complaining about that for how long? Yeah, at least 2 years. Yeah, so I'm all for, you know, the league trying to, you know, manufacture this. Sometimes the stuff they manufacture hits. Is the animosity there? Maybe not yet. I mean, I remember, you know, a number of Open Cup games over the years. We were in the same league with them our last fateful year in USL, you know, championship before, you know, League One started. So it's not like it's starting totally fresh. But I think there's a lot of room for growth to actually, you know, become the quote unquote real rivalry.
Yeah. I'm kind of in between y'all too. Like, I don't feel like it's a rivalry game or a derby. I just feel like it's a game between teams that are close to each other. But I also feel as if there is something there. But like you said, Shanair, like, it has to be organic. It can't be this forced thing, you know,
that the league track forces. Like, for example, you look in MLS, like, I think here in American soccer, because the country is so big and teams are so far from each other, we cannot define our derbies the same way the English do, because the English, their derbies are based on location. For example, you have the Manchester Derby, the Merseyside Derby, North London Derby. It's because those two teams share a same territory. I think here, derbies, or as we call them, rivalry weeks, are situations in which something happened in the past. There's a history between these two teams. Like, for example, there was a long period of time where Chicago Fire and New England Revolution had this rivalry. There was always yellow cards flying whenever they played. There was always drama. There was always a major, you know, almost fights and hard tackles and you know, things of that nature. And goals against those opposing teams meant more. You have those situations, but that's something that needs to grow. You can't, the first season we're in the same league, you say, all right, this is a derby. No, I mean, there needs to be some history. There needs to be some precedent of some drama, that some unfinished business, basically, because that's where rivalry stems from. It stems from unfinished business. So there needs to be some unfinished business before you can start talking about rivalry or a derby.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that. I don't care enough about this topic, to be totally honest, to really, you know, get into it. But I will say that, you know, Elliot's, you know, absolute, you know, masterpiece of branding with the Henny Derby.
Hell yeah.
Came game one of season one against them. So.
But that would be some off pitch history, like some off pitch event that created that. Yeah. You know,
look, yeah.
Man, but social media has a place in this.
But anyway, I will say, you know, if you watch those last 10 minutes of that game, you know, on Saturday, you could see some seeds being planted of, you know, a little bit of a heated rivalry, because, you know, you saw how many North Carolina players, you know, suddenly had, you know, amputation requiring injuries, you know, right then, you know, sometimes, you know, two of them, you know, at once, and then, oh, look, they're okay. They're fine all of a sudden.
Everyone's falling all over the place trying to make sure.
But that lets you know one thing, though, that, and you can see the Richmond Kickers were not doing that. North Carolina were playing for the draw. If they're doing stuff like that to waste time and it's nil-nil, they were playing for the draw. They realized, we're not going to score here, so we're going to play for the draw. We're going to make sure they can't score. We're going to kill the clock. And that's all they were doing. They were just, all of a sudden I have my hamstrings tight. I need to stretch it.
So actually, Jared, that's a good point you brought up. So let's go ahead and start there. So while we're watching the game, we're all like on the edge of a seat, you know, watching a game live, you're in a different atmosphere of watching. You're in a different, you did. When you go back and watch this game, and I was telling Matt beforehand, I actually feel like this is probably Richmond's best performance of the year so far. One being said, just because my biggest issue so far out of the first five games we played was the midfield. I feel like the midfield was okay. I feel like it was better than what it was in the other game. I feel like we put out the fires that were there. Now, before I say this, JT, for North Carolina, number 19, Homeboy is good. Homeboy is good. He created 9 chances by himself. The next closest person on North Carolina created 1. Homeboy's good. And it wasn't aware to me that he was on loan from Louisville City, and you know how Louisville City is with our players. But I felt like the midfield was good. I'm still trying to figure out what exactly Victor is doing. Because I know what Neil is doing, and I know what Zaka is doing. I'm just trying to figure out what that other midfielder is actually in there to do. But outside of that, I felt like the midfield played a lot better game. The back four, unless barring injury, that back four should be able to stay out there all year long. There's no reason to change it. But what do you guys think?
I think, yeah, you're looking at JT as he's basically their version of Sweet Feet, because he was out there. He was putting some pressure on the defense throughout pretty much the whole first half and a decent portion of the second half. I think after legs started to get heavy, he started to get a little more quiet in the second half as we started to push up the field more. But you're right. I do feel that there was a little bit of ambiguity in the midfield. Victor Falk, I wasn't exactly sure what his role was. Not to say that he didn't play well, but I think we would need to see a little bit more of this trio in the middle for me to really understand what Victor's role is. But apart from that, I mean, the back line, like you said, solid. They just need to stick with that back four, barring injury or fatigue. That four needs to stay and not be tweaked unless it absolutely has to. And I mean, and we created chances, and the flanks were very well taken care of and very well handled.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Victor played well. I don't have an issue with anything that he's doing. I don't think we need to worry about is he's a midfielder. So instead of maybe trying to look at it as, okay, he's a destroyer, he's a regista, he's a attacking midfielder. I think his role is midfielder. Do what needs to be done in the middle, of the field. If that's, spraying passes, spray some passes. If that's, getting, stuck in and putting a body on someone and, being an enforcer, that's being an enforcer. So I think he's, kind of the jack of all trades, guy in the middle there. If we need to be able to bunker in, he slides right in next to Zaka and you say, all right, come at us. If you need to be able to, try to, play those big, long diagonal balls to, Bolaños or Oleg or Boldic or whoever. You can hit those, So I, that's how I would probably, look at it. Is he's, the Swedish Army knife in the middle.
Yeah, probably so. So it looked like the starting formation was that of the 4-3-3 that we've always seen, but it felt like the midfielders were more pushed up versus what we saw before. They weren't really hugging onto the touchline as much. I did remember seeing, going back and watching through the game, there's a lot of times where when we're in attack, Bolaños would tuck in besides Terzaghi, and Monty would kind of push up to kind of be like an extra midfielder and kind of almost cover that space for Neil. Because I think, Matt, you probably were playing about like how Neil kind of like drift inside to be more of an attacking mid almost. So, like, in defense, he kind of drops in to be a center mid. He's not doing a whole bunch of defensive work. Like we said, he's not the fastest. But when we're in attack, he'll kind of operate that center space to be that connected piece to Zaghi. And then Bolaños will kind of drift in a little bit further in or tuck inside. And then Monty will kind of do that overlap run, which we saw a lot of Ian last year. And I'm starting to wonder, is Monty's role, because I feel like Monty really is kind of like the key piece in this team, almost attacking wise, because if he's able to get outside, able to cross that ball in, it's like 2-3 guys are able to be kind of in that box, kind of, for the cutback pass. Where on the other side, Calvo is kind of almost being like a right center back. slash like fullback in terms, whether or not we're playing offense or defense. Did you guys see the same thing, or I'm looking at it? It's totally weird.
No, I don't think you're off base at all. I think the attack is a lot more fluid when the full the fullbacks are able to really press high and provide service from the wing. I think we saw that last year, whether it was Antley or Scotty Thompson on the left side, were a lot more effective when they were able to really get involved in the attack. It doesn't mean they have to get all the way down to the end line every time, but if they're able to provide support for whichever winger is out there, be able to provide another outlet for one of the midfielders to be able to get the ball to, because it'll help. What those runs can help to do is help to unbalance the defense, because I think otherwise it gets really easy to defend where our attackers are, whether it's Emmy or Hernan or whoever in the middle. It makes it a lot easier to be able to collapse on them. It makes it easy to be able to take out Emmy or Neil, whoever's in the center, because there aren't as many options out wide. I would agree. I think I don't know if I go so far as to say it's the absolute key. I still think getting Emmy involved is the absolute key and ultimate decider of is our attack effective game to game, but it's a really important piece of it that makes that Emmy piece a lot easier.
And the reason why I think Monty is probably the key is because, like you said, like Emmy is the crown jewel is in this whole thing. But I think when Monty's able, for prime example, I think it was for one of the chances, he had a nice cross. But Emmy was just pretty much able just to kind of like freelance and just run around and just, able to take a shot and go. But he's freed up because Monty made that run, the long was gripped in. And now the defense is kind of in scramble mode, running back. I'm like, who's picking up who? And then another player who I'll probably say he had his best game of the year is Matt Boulder. Like, the shot he had in section Oyo, I thought it went in.
You need to be more specific.
Which one? That pinged off the post?
Yes, the one that hit off the post. Like,
which one?
Oh, the first one.
When he square off of it, like deemed it.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, that was.
I know. And watching it again Oh, you good, Shinier? You're gonna go.
No, I was gonna say that you could see that all of those missed chances were really getting to Matt. He later in the game, when you saw in the second half, he really started to get frustrated every time we missed a chance. And it really felt like we couldn't buy a goal if we wanted to. Like, it was just not in the cards. But he was a complete menace on that right side. He was a menace. The other team did not know what to do with him.
Yeah, I mean, he was getting a lot more space. I think, him looking frustrated, I think that's just him. He's probably absolutely the number one player on the team who wears his emotions on his sleeve on the field. At this point, after seeing him for 4 or 5 years, that doesn't faze me at all, to see that from him. I'd be more surprised if I saw him just stoic and without emotion in some way. But those shots in the first half, and I'm sure we'll talk about the other one coming up in a little bit, because that was crazy as well. What shows me is, I think his confidence is, coming, back up a little bit more, because he's looking to, take those shots. I think one of the problems, the attack has had, in recent weeks is, maybe being a little more reluctant to shoot early and looking for that perfect opportunity, looking for that perfect second, third pass instead of just letting rip sometimes.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes with, getting comfortable. Like, this is game 5, so now, like, the legs underneath you, you're no longer in that preseason mode. We've also had 2 weeks for really any kinks to come out. Granted, have things been a lot better if we scored a goal? Yes. But in the rally that we're living in, coming out of a draw where I would say we created a lot of chances, the offense didn't look as standing as it did in that, like, Greenville game, for instance. And we didn't have the defensive barriers as we did in the Fort Lauderdale game. I got to say, I'm kind of positive about it. Now, there were, like, a couple of moments where you're kind of, like, biting your fist. It's like, hey, guys, I need y'all to get it together. And one of those came right at the end of the half where Chrysler Now, granted, he should have put more power behind this to get it to Akira. He kind of just taps it and not realizing that the striker's name is eluding me right now, but the striker was just running onto it. And if it's not for Akira having the, like, presence of mind to just, I don't think he got a hand to it. I think he just really just, like, shoulder checked it out of balance. But it's like that moment was kind of nerve wracking. And then, like, JT, he crossed on Monticelli. Monticelli got to eat that. He got crossed up. But, like, in stadium, I thought that ball was a lot closer. Like, you're going in, like, tipping over the line. Watching the replay, it was nowhere near. Like, I think Monty was there. Calvo and Chrysler were all there, kind of, like, to cut out the chance of anything dangerous happening. But, once again, the back four, I have a lot of confidence in of, like, cleaning up those errors. I saw a little Chrysler, like, not putting enough power behind the ball. The back four probably they play almost a near perfect game.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point you can count on, all right, the way we're set up, they're going to give you that look from like 25 yards out or so, and okay, if you can beat a cure from there, good for you. But you're probably not going to get much more than that. You might get one better look than that a game, so you better be able to finish it, and can't ask for much more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you can keep teams to try and pop shots from 25, 30 yards out from most of the game, you're good. I mean, you're deep. And like you said, if you make it, kudos to you. But I do not see a lot of players in League One hitting screamers like that on a regular basis.
Right. You might lose one or two games a year that way, but you're going to win a lot more.
From keeping them far away from your goal. Exactly.
Yeah, I think the other thing about this game that really kind of caught my attention was, okay, so I'm going to ask you guys. So for Bologna, do you kind of feel like he, not like a free roam, but do you guys feel like he was kind of playing like a striker position in this game just because of how close he was tucked inside and like how many times it was almost like ping the ball long to him, to Bologna, let him get it behind the defense? Because he had a chance, I think, right before halftime where I don't see how that ball did not go over the line. Like he had two where one, I don't know if he hits it out or the defender, but it just rolls out of bounds. And then he had another one where I think if he just chips it, like maybe like a half an inch higher is in the back of the net, which still blows my mind that neither one of those chances went in the net.
I think Bolaños, it was more like he was playing kind of a narrow left wing. Because you could see that when we were on the attack, you still had Matt Baldock covering that right winger space every time we were pushing up in the attack, and Bolaños on the left, and you'd have Terzaghi in the middle. Now, Bolaños would tuck in a little more, but he was still occupying that left side, and a lot of those long balls that were going to him were kind of on the inside of the channel, basically. Running on the inside and on the left side. So, I mean, I don't know. I think it works because he's kind of in that limbo space where it's hard to figure out exactly who's going to mark him, whether it's going to be fullback, whether it's going to be the right-sided center back. And sometimes maybe the midfielder would have to drop back to cover the difference between the two, which would leave more space in the midfield when he does receive the ball. But I think it really does work with him being kind of in that space, that ambiguous space of, I don't know if he's a winger or a striker, because then the other team doesn't know if he's a winger or a striker, and it makes it hard for them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, when it comes to, like, so Emmy is one person, though, I think, that I was kind of losing track of, because I'm used to seeing a striker up top being there in front of the line. But I feel like Emi now is kind of doing, I'll call it like the Terry on re-roll, just to give it like a role definition, where he's not really a striker. He's kind of like, and he's not an attacking mid. He kind of just free roams, kind of does what he wants. He'll, if he doesn't feel like he's getting the ball enough up top, he'll drop back into the midfield spot to kind of pick up the ball and then spray it out. And that's all fine and dandy, but I feel like in this game, like, you needed like a striker like Hernan. And I know I was telling y'all at the game, like, I've talked all this trash about Hernan, and then all of a sudden, like, this game, we really need him really bad. And I'm like, well, dang, now I got to eat crow. But I feel like this would have been a perfect game for Hernan, because so everything that Rich was doing was kind of the same thing that North Carolina FC was doing. And a lot of fans were talking about it, like, why are we pressing more? Why aren't we, you know, stepping up, causing confrontation? But I think, out of everything, I think this is Darren Sawatzky's team. Like, this is how a Darren Sawatzky team is. You're not going to see the super-duper high press. They'll press in certain moments or certain situations where they feel like, hey, we can win the ball. But outside of that, is normally it's going to be a mid-block, you know, kind of everyone's tucked inside, and it's like you're either going to have to go around us to beat us, like we said, like those pop shots, but we're going to have everything inside kind of locked down, and you're going to have to either go around us or get in behind us. And I don't see that happening with this Richmond team. And if, for North Carolina, on the other hand, it felt like a lot of what they were doing was just, all right, like you said, Shanira, they just wanted to play that counterattacking game. If a chance arises out of individual brilliance, then great, we'll take it. If not, you know, we're fine sitting in this, like, low, not, I wouldn't say like parking a bus, but more of this low block, you know, we'll kind of just shift side to side and try to cut out fires when need be. However, in saying that, I do feel as if, like we all saw it, JT, number 19, he was an issue. And I feel like Sawatzky kind of made a change where he was just like, all right, Zaka, I need you to man mark this guy, get him tired, and, like, don't worry about, you know, doing the offensive part. Like, defensively, I need you to just stay on him. Wherever he goes, you go. And later in the game, it was like JT will start up in the middle, then he'll kind of go right and then go left. But then after a while, he just kind of stayed on the left side. He was trying to get space, and he was just like, all right, I can't find space like how I normally.
Yeah, I think in the second half, by then, and, you know, Darren kind of got it figured out by putting on him, and he basically tired his legs out. Like, he got to the point where he was like, I'm not going to run around anymore. Do that or I'm out for the season, you know. I do feel that one thing that I did say in the stadium, and when rewatching the game, I felt again was North Carolina's back line was very playable. Like, they were not the best back line we've come up against. I could see Matt getting in behind very easily, Bolaños getting in behind very easily, Emi getting in behind very easily. When Hernan did come on, you could see him dominating them in the air fairly easily on the few chances that the ball did come into the box in the air or outside of the box in the air. Their back line was very, very fragile, and I do feel that this is, you know, a lot of people would say, like, with this kind of borderline between a point gain and 2 points is points loss. I think that leans us more towards 2 points loss because of the fact that back line could have been cooked. We could have cooked them so bad. And going back to what you were saying about Hernan, that is why this was the perfect game for him. Now, Hernan is not good for every game. That's certain games we need that pace. We need that mobility up front. But in this game, the mobility wasn't all that necessary because we had the wingers that could circles around the guys anyway. We needed a strong presence in the box with Terzaghi behind to create some more chaos. And I think that's when we saw a little bit more. We really
saw how North Carolina would literally drop onto their heels later on in the second half when Hernan didn't come on. Then, of course, Olex is also creating a lot of problems for them.
Yeah, so a lot of things to kind of go back over. So Ellie, you mentioned that you saw Emmy playing like a honoree type role. I might look at it more of one of his countrymen. And I'm not saying he's anywhere near the same level. Yeah, but the way that Emmy's playing center forward, I'm going to. The way he's playing center forward, looks to me a lot more like how Leo Messi would play center forward. Because I was Henri was more of a kind of almost left winger forward hybrid kind of guy. And Messi, we'll see that he'll drop back in. He'll go get the ball if he needs to get the ball. He's not he can play in the air if he really needs to. But that's not his thing. Sounds a lot like Emiliano Tirzaghi, to me. I mean, unfortunately, he does not have that same left foot, that Leo had. I mean, if he did, he wouldn't be here. Let's be real. But I look at least, the very, very core of the stylistic, comparison. I see, their style of playing center forward, more compatible, in that way. So I don't know if I'm the only one that's seeing it like that, but that's kind of what would come to my mind a little bit when you were giving the Henri comparison.
No, you're not. I can see that as well. That probably is the better comparison about Emiliano, because there's a lot of times, like I said, there's a lot of times in the game where I'm looking and I'm like, all right, where is Emmy? Like, where is he at? And then usually he's the one picking up the ball. Now, he's not dropping in between the center backs or anything like that. Like, he'll try to drift off into the wing or whatnot, kind of in the Neil spot. And Neil's another player that I want to talk about, but I'm putting it at this point. But Emmy will kind of do that. He'll kind of drop back into the midfield, pick up the ball, and kind of start to play or kind of create space or overloads on the right side or the left side, opening up for Matt or Polonia.
Yeah. And I mean, it also goes back to that same debate we had for the first four episodes of the season of where do you play Emmy? Is he, you play him up front, do you play him in the 10? You look at some of those debates that were around Messi for forever. Where do you best play him, because you can dribble the whole team. So obviously you have that idea that you want to play him further back, but you also want him close to goal because he scores like every shot he takes, it feels like. So there's some parallels there, and I just wish he was even like 30% of what Messi was, because that'd be amazing.
I mean, to be honest with you, 30% of what Messi's got, and he would not be playing for the Richmond Kickers either. But
I was trying to figure out what percentage I could get away with without being too over the top. It's still way too good for us.
Yeah, maybe 10.
Without it also being really potentially insulting if by any chance you actually listen to this.
Yeah. But I mean, at the end of the day, like you said, like Messi, Emmy is a floater. He's that player you put in. He at kickoff, he's the nine, but once the game's going, you go wherever you feel you need to go, because he's got the IQ, he's got the skills, he's got the smarts in order to be in the right place and to create from almost anywhere on the field or anywhere in the final third. I do feel that it takes a special team and it takes a special tactic to be able to function regularly with a floater. And I think Darren is still trying to figure that out with regards to, okay, we're going to have you as the floater. What does that mean for everyone else around you? And I think that's where we're starting to see a form of that. We're starting to see what that looks like.
Yeah, like me and Ellie, you and I were talking about that before we started recording. I was trying to figure out, okay, so we got Emmy, we got Neil, who seems to be establishing himself in the team. We also have Hernan, as a center forward option. And I was trying to figure out, how do you get all three of those guys on the field together at the same time? Because I don't have a really good answer for that yet.
So I think I'll say it again. I think the best way how you do it is you leave Neil in his natural position, because Neil's not going to give you, he's not going to come back on defense like that. We've seen that. He's not the quickest, not the fastest, not the strongest. but his dribbling in the mid-post spot is really, really key. I think you can get away, especially in League One, of putting Emmy out on the wing. Maybe left or right doesn't matter. I think you can just flip him and Bolognese and him and Bolognese. I think it really doesn't matter. I think you can put Hernan on top. I think that will probably be your best version of how to get all three on the field at once, because Emmy will, he won't really play the wings, but he'll kind of play the Matt Baldock role. I mean, you probably have to grab Matt Baldock, but I think you can put Emmy there, and then Emmy will do the work of getting up top, having those crosses in, but also coming inside and cutting inside and opening up space for the fullback to kind of go in behind. So in an ideal world, I would probably more or less put him on, I would put him on the left wing. Because he's right, I believe Emmy is right-footed, right? So I'll put him on the right, put him on the left side. That way he can cut inside and shoot off his right. Or he could go to this, goal line and kind of cut it back in for a cross. But then also that allows Monty to kind of come in behind him and do this, crossing it as well.
Yeah, I mean, now that I think about it, probably the real answer would be you have to go like old school 4-4-2 style. Then that completely messes everything else up that we have going on, our wingers in midfield and everything else. So
exactly.
But that's why we're really Darren's making the big bucks.
That's why Darren makes the real decisions.
It's really tough because I still feel that Emmy can literally play between a second striker and an attacking midfielder. Like that's his niche. And if you have Hernan on the field, you have the idea of it's, you can simply work big man, fast man with Hernan and Emmy. But then, like you said, Matt, if you're playing a 4-4-2, where does that leave Neil? Where does that leave our wingers? Where does that leave everyone else? It makes it a lot harder unless you're playing with two up front and three in the back, and then you've got another issue to deal with. If you're playing with three in the back, you got five in the midfield, two wing backs, and maybe three midfielders. Then you can kind of fit Neil and Zaka and Falk in there. But then your wing backs, we're not sure exactly how that would work. It's just makes it very difficult. Where does that put Bolaños? Where does that put Matt Baldock? Matt Baldock can play wing back, but then when you bring Olex onto the field, where does that put him? It's trying to fit Terzaghi in a specific position leaves so many more questions, which is why I think Darren is like, just go out there and float, and we'll just place everyone else around you.
yeah, more than likely. I think another player that I could definitely see that he's getting, like we said, Mike Boulder is getting something. Another player I think is getting his confidence as well is Neil Vinos. Not necessarily this game because he didn't really have a shot of goal, but I feel as if he's probably one of the more effective players and quietly one of the more effective players offensively. I think when I was looking at the stats, I think he had 5 chances created, which led the team for the game, but he also had 3 duels won. Now, granted, he lost 5, but that's also the kind of player he is. He's very dribbly. He's a very like attacking minded player. I feel like if Neil can get, I wouldn't say calm, because I don't think he's like calm, but I think if Neil can string together a couple of performances where he's one of the best players on the field, I think that goes a long way as well, of kind of opened up the floodgates even more. Because we saw it, like, he had one chance, or he left it off to Zaghi, where he dribbled damn near through 3-4 players and almost laid off a chance that no one, it came created out of nowhere. So I feel like we could get Neil kind of in those opportunities, in those parts more, I feel like it's going to raise the profile of the team going forward. It is kind of one of those things where you have all of the attention, because now I feel like Bolognese is starting to get that attention as well, where they're telling one player, like, hey, focus on him, the same way they're doing with Chizagi. And it's kind of leaving Neil opening these little pockets where he'll just pop up and lay a pass off here, and he'll make a move, something like that. So it's almost becoming one of the things that Neil could get going. Now it's kind of like you got 3 fires to put out, and which fire do you put out first?
Or which one don't you put out, and you pick your poison. you know, sort of scenario, who are you going to say, all right, you got to be the one to try to beat me today? But yeah, I think Vinyals, I think the way I would, you know, kind of put it is, you know, the ball sticks to him in the good way, not in the black hole, you know, kind of way, you know, where the ball sticks to you because you're never passing it. But you know, you see, you know, the ball come into him, and he's really good on, you know, getting the ball and being able to immediately turn, you know, with it and be able to, you know, create that little bit of space for himself. Because yeah, like you've mentioned before, he's not a burner. You know, he's not going to be a JT Kamara and, you know, take the ball and, you know, dribble, you know, eight guys because he can just dribble past them. You know, Neil has to more, you know, dribble through a few guys if he's going to, you know, beat them. And he's capable of that. We've seen that over the last few games. I thought Saturday was his best performance of the season, you know, so far. I felt a lot more, you know, positive, you know, in terms of being able to progress the ball. So I think it's going to, you know, come as, you know, probably learning, you know, continue to learn a little bit more of the timing with, you know, the, you know, forward line. Neil was out for a little bit of the, you know, preseason, so I think he's, you know, finally fully catching up and, you know, ready to go.
Yeah, for real, for real. And one more player we've definitely got to shout out is Oleks Anderson. And I'm going to ask you guys again. I feel like I ask you guys this question every week. Are you guys finally ready to commit to Oleks is the super sub of the team? Like, every time he comes on, there is a performance this guy pulls out of nowhere.
I think it can be.
I mean, I think
I want to see a week where we have Terzaghi up top, Bolaños, and Oleks on the wings. And then I want to judge it. Because if I think if you have those three up front, it is very difficult for any team to handle that much pace, power, talent, and just grit. Oleks is a nuisance when he has a ball like if at his feet. I feel bad for fullbacks when he's coming at them. Bolaños has pace, and now he's starting to get much better control with the ball at that pace. Terzaghi is Terzaghi. He's MVP. It speaks for itself. So if you have those three up front, I think Oleks can perform better in conjunction with those other two. And I do feel that that's one thing we have not seen. We have not seen those three up front. Every time one of them comes on, one of the other two is coming off. And because of that, we're not seeing what that potential could be. Because if I think maybe if you have those three up front, you have Vignal, Falk, and Zaka in the midfield behind them, we probably got something on our hands there. I want to see what that looks like before I put him in the role of super. Because, yes, he can play the role of super sub fantastically, but can he give us 90 minutes of greatness with those other two on the field?
Yeah, I think I'm in kind of the same boat there. Oleks started the Fort Lauderdale game. He wasn't the problem that game. You know, he was, you know, creating, you know, some chances, you know, all the way up until, you know, late in the game when his, you know, shin guard exploded or whatever that was, you know, in that, you know, moment. And but you know, he was pretty dangerous throughout the whole game. So I think we've, you know, been able to see, and even at the end of last year, we can see that he can impact a game from the beginning. He doesn't need to come on at 70 minutes, you know, to be able to impact a game just against you know, supposedly tired, you know, players. You know, so I think it's a matter of, you know, looking at matchups, looking at, you know, okay, what are we, you know, what does Darren want to accomplish, you know, with the team, you know, this game, what are the, you know, little tactical, you know, quirks? I mean, be real, who's going to pick up some injuries? It's going to be a long season. There's going to be some guys that'll pick up a little nagging injury, you know, miss a game or two. There'll be yellow card suspensions down the line. You pick up, you know, so we're going to need that little bit of, you know, rotation in there. So like I said before, like Shaneer said, I think, yes, he can play that role, but yeah, I think it's going to be, you know, even more meaningful if, you know, he can also start, you know, not all the games, but, you know, somewhat regularly and be able to impact the team that way too.
Yeah, for real. And I mean, at time of recording right now, I haven't seen anything about whether he got called into the St. Vincent and Grenadines CONCACAF Nations League squad or anything like that. So if we see anything like that, fans will definitely keep you up to date on whether or not he get called up. I think if he does get called up, he'll miss the Revs 2 and the Fort Lauderdale game, right? I mean, not Fort Lauderdale, Fort Madison game, correct? if he gets called up?
I'm looking it up right now.
Yeah, I think those are the first two games. Those are the two first games in June, and that's when that's around that time. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, he'll definitely miss on those games. He'll go back for the Union Omaha game.
Yeah, they play on the 4th, and they play on the 8th.
Yeah,
and,
so
let's
so
be real, we've already established. Yeah, we've already established they're not advancing, so those would be the last ones.
Okay. All right, man. Well, yeah, so if he does get called up, which I'm imagining he does, I think he'll miss on those two games, and we'll see. So, Shanir, I know that you usually hate it when a goalkeeper gets man of the match or whatever, but I will have to say, if I have to give out a grade so far for this team, I'm giving the defense definitely an A, not an A+, but I'll give him an A. Karen, he did have 4 saves, but out of those 4 saves, one of those he really had to pull out of, like, his, like, he had to pull out of somewhere. The 1.5. The other one, it was straight to him, but he punched it away. It wasn't really nothing too dangerous. Unlike North Carolina's goalkeeper, he had 2 diving saves. And, like, those 2 diving saves were saves where if he's maybe, like, 1/2 inch shorter, it's in the back of the net.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think McGuire probably had the better saves. I think Akira had a bigger number total. And, again, let's be real, we already established, you know, the league doesn't look that closely at you know all the games. They look at the stats, you know, more than anything else. If you score a goal, you're going to be on team of the week. You know, most times, if you got a clean sheet, you know, as a defender or a keeper, you're probably a lot more likely to get on there. And I think Akira had credit with 4 saves versus McGuire's 2, but I think McGuire's 2 were far more challenging than Akira's 4.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. I mean, he was scrambling for at least to get 2 of them. I think what was the Olex header. The 2nd half was one, and of course, like the Matt Bullock one, where honestly, it wasn't until I went back and rewatched the game. I know I'm just saying there's a lot, but when you go back and rewatch games, you pick up on a lot of stuff that you missed in game. The one where Matt had it at the top of the box, he shot it. I thought it was just a weak shot. But when I rewatched it, I realized like it took a deflection and it threw the goalkeeper all along. Like, he was diving to his left, and then he just recovered out of nowhere. Like, I don't know what kind of balance this man has, but he was able to shift from all his weight going down in one direction to, like, a split second of going right and getting a fingertip on it. The ball pops up, and he's able to grab it. Yeah.
Yeah, no. I do think, to be honest with you, in this game, I don't agree with Kira getting man of the match. To be honest with you, even though it's clean sheet, even though there were some great saves, I don't think either goalkeeper gets man of the match in this game, because a lot of the missed chances were not saved. They were off target or hit the woodwork. And because that kind of, to be honest with you, especially in the 2nd half, Akira did not really have much to do because we were on the front foot so much. But even though we were on the front foot so much, McGuire didn't really have all that much to do. Yes, he had to be a lot more attentive than Akira, but he didn't have as much to do as you would expect from a goalie who's gonna get man of the match, or in Akira's case also getting man of the match. Opinion, it's very tough to find a man of the match in this gun, but I would probably have given it to Matt. Matt was consistently a threat throughout the entire game. He missed a couple chances. There was that one where he takes that shot, it takes a deflection and almost wrong foots the goalkeeper. The one where he bangs it off the post. He had a lot of crosses coming in from that right side in the 2nd half. He made a nuisance of himself to the other team with and without the ball. So, in my opinion, I think Matt Bolduc should have gotten man of the match and not Akira. Not to take anything away from Akira. Akira was, I mean, with that, especially that save, that cross that came over, and literally point blank, he takes that one off his chest to save it.
that was he definitely had a great performance, but I don't think enough happened on his end for him to get man of the match.
Yeah, I mean, if we're looking at the big picture and not just, you know, the kicker's awarded man of the match, obviously they're always going to give it to a kicker's player. They're not going to give it to an opposing. I mean, JT Kamara was clearly the best player on the field. You know, throughout the game, we've talked about that probably ad nauseum way more than we should on a, you know, podcast for a, you know, a team that, you know, that he doesn't play for. So all things being equal, that's probably who I would have given it to if I could give it to somebody on either team. For the kickers, I'm fine with it. If you want to give it to Akira, I would have been fine with it if you gave it to Jalen or, you know, Yvonne, you know, either, because they were just vacuuming up, you know, everything, you know, that, you know, came in, you know, to the middle. They were, you know, ones that were usually putting the final stop onto, you know, Kamara, or, you know, Chrysler was doing a really good job of, you know, kind of, you know, bodying up against, I think his name was Simpson, the big center forward, you know, for North Carolina. So, I mean, that guy has been a revelation for me so far this year. Like, when we signed, you know, him in the off season, I was like, okay, he's a guy. Yeah, I didn't think, you know, too much of it, but I mean, he has been a stud in the back so far, and, you know, he completely deserves, you know, starting to get that recognition, you know, making team of the week, you know, getting that shine, because, you know, he has taken that spot next to Yvonne and, you know, just stamped it on, you know, as his. And you know, anybody wants to, you know, try to get it, you know, come get it, but you're not going to.
Yeah. Look, if there's one thing Richmond knows how to do really, really well, it's make center back pair duos and a goalkeeper. Never have to worry about that with Richmond.
Like, oh, yeah. We've always had great, great center back pairings. For as long as I've been in Richmond, it's always been, you know, two defensive giants back there, you know, and that link up well, that know how to play with each other and just have a great chemistry. It's always been great.
There's one I didn't care for, but we don't need to get into that.
Yeah, no. Let's sweep that under the rug. Let's sweep
that
under the rug.
That was a fluke.
So that pretty much wraps up that game. I think we did a good job of breaking out, like, a lot of the questions that we were hearing on Saturday, kind of talking through the team. So, of course, it's Memorial Weekend. I'm going to tell you right now, we're probably not going to record on Sunday or on Monday, because we're probably going to be drunk somewhere at a beach. I'm telling you right now.
I wish. I am coaching a tournament that weekend, so I will be in Williamsburg.
Very patriotic.
I know. It's the perfect town for it, right?
Right. Very patriotic. But on the 29th, we play Chattanooga Red Wolves, a team that we have not beaten in our last five attempts. Our only win that came against them in our first match against them. Chattanooga right now is undefeated, 2 wins, 1 draw. But I will say this, having watched Chattanooga, I've watched all three of their games for Walking 90. I will have to say they've been kind of lucky. All three of those games could have been draws. Definitely the Revs 2 game should have been a loss. I don't know how Revs gave up 2 goals. I do know how to give up 2 goals. They can't play defense with the lick. No. But outside of that, you know. Yeah, I don't feel like Chattanooga really should have been there. You know, Fort Lauderdale and North Texas, the other one. So they, all three of their games so far have been against 2 teams. They haven't played. We're their first independent team of this year that is playing. So they'll play against a team of actual adults and not kids. How are you guys feeling going into this game? Are you optimistic? Are you kind of just like even keel about it? Are you a little bit worried? Where are you guys at? And also, this game was not going to be at 4 p.m., so make sure that you check what time this game is. Chattanooga has lights now. They finally paid the light bill. This game will be at 7 p.m. Chenier just, like, had a big awe face because he's shocked.
Oh, they got some lights.
Yeah, they finally paid the light bill.
Oh, they finally paid it. All right. Well, I don't know. For me,
I don't think it's like you said that they're of their three games, there hasn't really been much that has really made me think, oh boy, that's a threat that we really, really, really need to think about. I mean, as a whole, I think as usual, Red Wolves have always been just an all around decent squad that for some reason had our number ever since after the first game we've ever played against them. I do feel that this season things are going to be different, though. I do feel around the time when we were playing Chattanooga last year, there were injury issues. There was still personnel ambiguity issues. I think right now the team is so solidified that we will be able to put on a good performance against the Red Wolves. I can see us maybe getting away with either a draw or a win, but I think it would be hard pressed for us to get a loss in this one. I mean, I would be very disappointed if we did.
I mean, I want to be optimistic, but yeah, let's think back to last year, and not necessarily the Chattanooga games. Let's think back to how we started last year. That was a team that found a way to win, you know, a lot of games that they maybe shouldn't have at times, that maybe should have been a draw, something. That sounds a lot like, you know, LA, what you were just talking about with Chattanooga so far this year. You know, good teams find a way to get, you know, that result that they, you know, maybe on face value don't deserve, but they get there. You know, and then three games is not a big sample size, admittedly, right? But it's start of a trend already. You know, and they have, and it's very different, you know, Chattanooga than the last few years. You know, Hurst is gone, Doyle's gone, Beattie's gone, you know, not, you know, the same usual suspects, you know, as before. But you know, they've got you know, Josue Espana, you know, he's got what, 3 goals in the last 2 games, you know, so far, you know, for them. You know, they got, you know, guys who can be able to you know, take care of business. They got Mensigan, you know, from you know, Lansing a couple years ago. They have players. You know, they have guys who can be able to actually, you know, do the job. You know, and right or wrong, our, you know, outside that first game, you know, we've maybe looked good at times, but the offensive production hasn't been great, you know, for the most part. You know, after the first game, there's been what, 3 goals? You know, Neal's, that, let's be real, that should not have been a goal. You know, that keeper, you know, stays at 999 out of 1,000 times, you know, probably. We had, you know, Emmy's first goal against Toronto, great goal, major credit there. And then the penalty, which, I mean, you earn penalties, but again, not creating a lot from the run of play, you know, in a way that, you know, seems replicable so far. And then you factor in, you know, the way it's going to be on turf. Who knows how that's going to, although I guess they did win their other game on turf this year, so maybe that actually works in our favor. So can we get a result? Absolutely. You know, but I don't think it's going to be something where it's a walk in the park by any means. It's going to be a, you know, hard-fought game. It's going to be something where you know, can't regress back to having those you know, little mental mistakes that end up, you know, with the ball in our net.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing to avoid in this match. I think Chattanooga's crowd would definitely be up for it. This is like an independent team coming in. But I think if we can avoid like the mental mistake, kind of play a solid game, not necessarily pay for a draw. Don't do that. Because you play for a draw, you're actually going to play. You're going to lose. But I think just more or less, you know, be safe in the back. And an opportunity arises, find ways how to get Emmy into dangerous pockets, Neil into dangerous pockets. Because Nils had success against Chattanooga, about if hit memory, you know, kind of plays right. He's had success against Chattanooga, finding danger pocket space, and whatnot. So, I think Nils is going to have a kind of a breakout game. I'm going to be looking forward to this. So, anything else from you guys before we wrap up today's show?
Yeah, I got one question for you all. So, it's about, you know, the substitute. You know, so I couldn't help but notice that, you know, Darren used only 2 subs this last game, and he's left subs on the bench, you know, in the past as well. Do you think it's a matter of, you know, just thinking that things are going well, doesn't want to mix it up? Is it, do you think there's, you know, like personnel issue there, because I'm thinking this last game. All right, we're probably chasing a goal at the end, because again, if we're taking Darren at face value, what was one of the first things, you know, he said when he came to the club, he's going to chase 3 points when he can, right? And he leaves, Stanley Alves, on the bench. He leaves, Cameron Vickers on the bench, who might have been able to help, try to create something, out of the midfield. Can't remember who else. I left Luke Buffone, on the bench, who, this year he's been playing right back, but we know he can, be a pest up front if necessary. I'm not saying that all of those guys, maybe should have been coming in, or all of them, would have guaranteed, a win. But I also just kind of wondering, okay, what's going on, there? What do you all think about, the substitution patterns?
I'm not reading too much into it. I think when he brought in Olex, I really thought he was bringing him in for Matt at the time. But when he left Matt on, and just substituted Olex in for Johnny, it was kind of like for like sub. And then Neil for Hernan, put a Hernan or something, and drop it in me back. Outside of that, I don't think there was a need to use all your substitutions. I think the subs rule is up to 5 this year, right, in USL?
It's the 5, but you still have the 3 windows.
The 3 windows, yeah. So I don't think there was a reason to go sub crazy. It wasn't as if we were chasing a goal, or it wasn't as if we were creating chances, or there wasn't a spark. The team was still producing. You still get up there. Granted, the ball was going to the back of the net. I think Alex and Hernan are like for like almost. So it's kind of like, well, which one are you going to put in there? Luke, I think more or less now, I think Luke is a defensive sub. And unless we're going to 3 in the back, I don't think there's a reason to put Luke in at the end of the game unless you're going to put him at wing back, just for defensive stabilities, because he's not a great 1-on-1 defender. And I'm trying to remember who else was on the bench.
Vickers.
Vickers is the one that I'm not quite certain of yet, because we haven't seen a lot of him. Like, he's kind of came in and like mop up to it. Like, he came in the last 2 minutes of the Ref 2 game. We've probably seen all of 3 minutes of him this year.
Yeah, not a big enough sample size.
Yeah, it's not enough for me to say what can he really do. Out of just seeing what he's done so far, he kind of reminds me of Matt Baldock. But at that same point, if it's the last 3 minutes of the game, and you know how the kind of player Matt is, are you really taking Matt out of the game to put Vickers in, and he hasn't really played a whole bunch? I don't think so. So I don't think substitutions or subs were a big turning point in this game.
The one that I'm a little confused about. I do agree with Hernan coming on over Stanley Alves, because for some reason so far this season, when Stanley Alves has been on the field, looks like he's been playing in a midfield role, which is something that I was not expecting this season. Last year we knew that Stanley Alves is a number 9, and he was signed to the Richmond Kickers as a number 9. That was his identity. We saw him preseason before COVID hit. We saw him playing as a 9, doing fairly well in the preseason as a number 9. So it's a bit, I don't know if it would have been a good idea to put him on, especially since all of a sudden he's playing a new position this year, which I personally don't know if it's a really good fit for him. As Elliot alluded to, Vickers, I feel, would be a like for like with Matt. Luke Pavone, I think, is the outlier, but it's the same situation as Stanley Alves. He's being played in a completely different position this year that he was last year. And when you're desperate to try and maybe salvage 2 points, do you put on someone who has literally spent an entire preseason trying to, basically he has been unmade and is being made into something else? It's not the time to try and revert him back, if you understand what I mean by that. So I think the substitutions, it was tricky. I personally think if you're trying to chase the game and trying to go after
that goal and to get that goal to secure 3 points rather than going away with one, if you're going to put Olex on, you leave Bolaños on. I personally think if you're going to go guns blazing, you need both of those guys on the pitch.
Yeah, I was just curious because most coaches I know like to play the cards available to them, and leaving some in your hand, it's just a different tactic.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. But we will see how Darren does. Also, I found out from our man Ian, which by the way wasn't him the best in recovery. Darren listens to the podcast, so yeah.
Yeah, we knew that when he moved Emmy back up front, right?
Yeah. We're like, oh, he listens. He hears us. He hears us. But yeah, man, before we wrap up, in the link down below, there is a link to a Google survey. The Red Army, the supporters of the Richmond Kickers, is having a town hall meeting with the front office. So make sure you fill out that form. Trust me, it's like 2 questions. It's not super duper hard. That event will be live streamed. We're just trying to figure out the time. And so if you're interested in that, make sure you fill out that form. But besides that, guys, anything else from y'all before we wrap up today's show?
Shout out to William Yambi and Braden Troyer for showing up, and especially to William Yambi for getting right in the mix with us with the Red Army and actually leading a chant.
Oh, my God. I want to say, yo, I died laughing for like 5 minutes when I heard Yambi. Oh, man, do the chant, yo. Because it was full accent, like full-blown accent. And that's all I heard. I just died laughing.
He may or may not have had to be fed the lines, too, which was hilarious to watch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Multiple people had to tell him the lines. Multiple people. Also, shout out to Braden Troyer because he's about to be a new dad, I think, in June or July.
Yes. Yeah,
congrats to him, man. Congrats to him. Yeah, man. Whew. All right, let's go and wrap up the show. All right, y'all. Once again, listeners, thank you guys so much for listening to us. As always, we can't do the show without your support. So always remember to like, share, subscribe. You can listen to the show on any podcast player. That's Google, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to your podcast at. As always, this is Elliot, my co-host Madden Chenier. We'll holler at you guys later. Be easy. We'll check you guys later on the good side.